Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I am Anna Fishson, your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Manya Steinkohler and Patricia Garavici about their edited volume, Lacan on Madness. Madness, Yes, You Can't, published by Routledge in 2015. So first, I'm going to introduce them briefly. Manya Steinkohler is a psychoanalyst and professor of English at Borough of Manhattan Community College. She's a member of Après Coup Psychoanalytic Association in New York and Espace Analytique in Paris, and works periodically at Barthélemy Durand Psychiatric Hospital in Paris. Manya is on the editorial committee of The Candidate. She's organized some great conferences in recent years, among them Psychoanalysis on Ice with Michael Garfinkel in Reykjavik in 2014, On Violence, Civilization, and Its Bliss Contents with Vanessa Sinclair, which I attended. It was a fantastic conference. On Laughter in 2013, and The Art of Madness in 2012, from which I think the present volume, at least partly inspired the present volume. So congratulations, Manya. I know how much work these conferences are. So she's also written many articles and papers on the voice, opera, and psychoanalysis, and these are topics near and dear to my heart. Okay, Patricia Garavici is a psychoanalyst at Après Coup and the co-founder and director of the Philadelphia Lacan Group. Her books include The Puerto Rican Syndrome from 2003, winner of the Gradivo Award and the Boyer Prize, and Please Select Your Gender, From the Invention of Hysteria to the Democratizing of Transgenderism, by Routledge 2010. They are both excellent books, and our very own Tracy Morgan actually interviewed Patricia on this program about Please Select Your Gender. Okay, so Manya and Patricia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Thank you for the invitation.
Sure. So for our audience out there, to minimize confusion, Patricia has the beautiful Argentine or Spanish-Argentine accent, and Manya has a lovely Soprano's voice, and I'm
your Brooklyn accent.
No. Well, I can't hear it because I probably have it too. So I'm the alto of the group, in case anybody hadn't noticed. Okay, so that's the vocal categorization. I want to jump right in by asking what led you to put together this collection. Maybe both of you can speak to this, And please, in your response, address the choice to focus on madness, which sounds to me like a cultural or literary term, rather than a clinical or specifically even like Lacanian category like psychosis. So who wants to start?
I'll jump in. I agree with you. We chose the word madness purposefully. It was the idea of a practice that unhappily has had a very bad influence, not just in psychoanalytic practice, but in many forms of clinical practice, which is using labels that soon acquire a derogative connotation. And we wanted to rescue the word Madness, which indeed has a lot of echoes, literary echoes in culture, but also is a word used in common day language, and try to rescue the world in all its horrors and glory, and reclaim madness with all its protean qualities, all the mysteries it entails, because it's a word that is hard to define, that has been quite controversial. And it allow us to maybe from the very start of the title of the book return to something that we find very essential in Lacan's originality when dealing with what we may call insanity, psychosis, strange behavior, unexplainable phenomena.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and madness doesn't, I don't think it really participates in this normal-abnormal kind of dichotomy, or it doesn't seem to be implicated in it.
Absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Manya wants to add something.
Yeah, maybe also I mean, Patricia's point about the idea of mystery was really important to both of us, and reacquaints us with the mystery of madness, which is covered over by pharmacology and diagnosis far too often. So we were kind of excited to have it kind of raise its ugly head in all of its beauty once again, if you want to, we could say it like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Anna, you also wrote an important point, which is that using the word madness that has this sort of difficult border that is permeable, we can put the so-called normal and abnormal together. That's something early on observed by Freud when he noted that the dreams of the sane and the dreams of the insane cannot be differentiated. They are the same dreams, and that maybe we could say that if we spend one-third of our lives sleeping, dreaming, hopefully, we spend a third of our lifetime in a state of madness. So that in universalized experience of madness, and at the same time, what we try to do in the book is to bring back to madness its clinical specificity, because another thing we noted is that was a shock listening to colleagues, and this is something we share a lot in conversation with Manya, there is not a clear notion of madness or psychosis, and it's very important, I think, clinicians have an ethical responsibility to know what kind of suffering they're dealing with when they work with a patient. And it was important to challenge maybe the negative aspect in terms of not using a diagnosis as a label, but reclaim also a specificity unique to structure, and that would be the way we will think about madness. And that's, I think, conveying our subtitle.
Well, I was going to ask you about the subtitle next, because I love the subtitle, Madness, Yes, You Can't. It's clearly a kind of tongue-in-cheek reference, I think, to Obama's campaign slogan, Yes, We Can, Maybe. But there's also, it seems to me, a reference to foreclosure, Lacan's concept of foreclosure. But maybe you can tell us.
Certainly. But and it touches, just like the idea of madness, the subtitle would touch on neurosis and psychosis. Certainly to foreclosure, because there is a kind of a limitation in the very infinity of the drive. And also, in neurosis, there's yes, but you can't, right? The function of the name of the father, right? So we tried to, and maybe just to go back to what Patricia was saying with the idea of madness and the subtitle, our book tries to spread out like a large swath of clinical worlds where we have, you know, an essay on femininity and ravage and crazy women and narcissistic neurosis and psychosis and institutional psychosis. So even the yes you can't touching on both of those on the structure, neurosis and psychosis.
Right, because certainly some of the chapters do deal with psychosis proper or more narrowly, I think, more than madness, the broader category, or if you will.
Mm-hmm. It's the idea of how they know, maybe in that yes, you can't, it sounds like a paradox, but that you cannot go crazy just because you wish to, that there has to be a structural allowance for that to occur, and how they can't, they know, which is another way of referring to Lacan's idea of the name of the father, how the law, the limit, may be inflicted on a subject in a manner that may produce a neurotic or may produce a person we may call psychotic or perverse, and we have essays that will be dealing with the specificity of these structures and how to approach them, because one interesting thing that we discovered in the research that led to this book is certain historical resistance to the application, and I choose that word purposely, of psychoanalysis to psychosis, as if that would be forbidden territory. Mm. And it was a shock, because in our own clinical experience, that was never the case. And historically, then that's the main title of the book, Lacan on Madness, mm-hmm. Lacan's own itinerary. He started working in the field of psychosis, and it was his encounter with madness that made him a psychoanalyst. When he was treating a patient that he called Aimé, he felt the need to go back and read Freud and read psychoanalysis. He needed psychoanalysis to deal clinically better with a case of a strange paranoid delusions. That psychoanalysis became essential to the treatment of psychosis.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I definitely... I want to get back to that as we talk about maybe some of the individual chapters, particularly the one by Jean Alouche. Is that the right pronunciation? Alouche?
Mm-hmm.
But we'll definitely, I want to ask you about that. But before we do, I did want to kind of, so people can orient themselves. I mean, the audience can be oriented. I wanted to talk a little bit about the structure of the book. It has... 18 chapters total, actually. It's pretty impressive. I'm not going to name everybody, but it's people like Paul Verhaga and Paolo Mieli and Genevieve Morel, Darian Leder, and, you know, the list goes on. And it's divided into three sections, which are Madness Manifest, Encountering Madness. So this is inside and outside the clinic. The Method of Madness, Thinking Psychosis. And then the third section, Madness and Creation, Environs of the Whole. That's H-O-L-E. So it's interesting because as you're speaking, I'm thinking about my own relationship. As I finished the book and I was thinking about the book structure and the individual chapters, I detected a kind of arc, if that's the right word, an underlying plot, which is it felt to me like madness is increasingly linked to creativity in the book, and the collection ends on this note. So in other words, earlier articles focus on pathology more, and the later ones link madness to freedom even. So I think in your intro, you say, I think you call them positive aspects and potential of madness. Was this very conscious? Did you intend for the, or maybe this is just the way I saw it, but it seemed to me that there was this movement.
Well, maybe we wanted to have this. Remember that for Freud even, the delusion is an attempt at a cure,
mm-hmm, right?
Right. And so that already there is a kind of metaphor making. You know, he calls it the delusional. Lacan calls it the delusional metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to emphasize the creative, the creative making that's at stake in madness, rather than its moral or like, oh no, we have to go in and cure it all the time. It's already a kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great inspirations for my working on this book was my work at Guidana's hospital in Paris, where you see how exciting a clinical team who, and they're all different. They're Kleinians, Winnicottians, whatever. But they've already, if you grew up in France, you studied Lacan. So even if they have, say, different, slightly different theoretical orientations, they have an understanding of psychosis via Lacan. And you can see, institutions created with that kind of theory in mind. And it's really exciting, the work they do. And that was part of the inspiration for the book.
Yeah.
I thought, very passionately, this should be something that English readers can experience.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe to extend a little on what Manya was saying, is we felt a need to make very important clinical work, very important theoretical contributions, available to an English-speaking audience. Many of the contributors to our collection have written books that are classics. For instance, Jean-Claude Malleval, Jean Alouche, you mentioned, Hector Yankelevich, they have made contributions that are constant references. And we felt that it was important, given us original clinical model, is a unique form of a treatment that needed to be, not because what we are discovering, and this is, I think, a unique moment in history in the United States. I have seen in the last 20, 25 years, I have seen a big change in the clinical field. There is a growing interest in the Lacanian contribution to the clinical practice. There was, of course, if we look back 20, 30 years ago, a lot of interest in the Lacanian contributions in film studies, in women's studies, but there wasn't the same curiosity we see today, because there is something very useful and original in the perspective that is granted by a structural thinking of psychosis. There is something new to say, and I think this is a way of seeing psychoanalysis, which I think the history of psychoanalysis, if we look at what was psychoanalysis in the 1950s in the United States and what has become earlier in our century, there has been a change, and I see in very recent years a positive change. It went psychoanalysis from being a practice that was aimed at the very rich and slightly neurotic, and now is seen as a practice that could have something helpful to contribute for the not so rich, but who may have severe diagnosis, and something useful could be offered for them.
Mm. Well, you know, since we're touching on Lacan's thinking on structure, maybe you can say, one of you, it's kind of difficult to do this in a, you know, and keep it short, but maybe one of you can say something about the way his ideas about madness or psychosis changed over time, because maybe homing in on the idea of foreclosure, and then his elaboration of maybe Freud's schizophrenia paranoia trajectory or the delusional metaphor, and then leading into the Centome of the 1970s.
I first wanted to add something to.
Oh, absolutely,
one of the things our book was aiming at is also the important idea that structure is not illness. Mm. You can be psychotic and not ill. Right? You could be neurotic and really screwed up. So the idea is it's an important distinction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons we were thinking of using the word madness to emphasize that. Right? Maybe quickly, and Patricia and I can do this together, but Lacan started, you know, with the M.A. and the Papin sisters, and with the imaginary, via psychosis that he can invent the idea of the imaginary in the 30s. In the 50s, it's Lacan's ideas about the symbolic, the signifier, and the name of the father, and the paternal metaphor. And that's when he uses in Seminar 3 the word foreclosure for the first time, thinking in those terms. But that's not the way he's going to keep thinking about psychosis. Psychosis would be the most Freudian and generative, structure for Lacan's work. It changes as he goes on. So in the 60s, he's going to think about the object and the kind of non-separation of the object that takes place in psychosis. And in the 70s, he's thinking about the Joyce and the Santum. Mm-hmm. So it's like a long trajectory of thinking about psychosis. And having worked with psychotic patients in a hospital, what's interesting is that there's a kind of creativity to the treatment team with all of these different. It's not like one is right. It's like where for one patient, the idea of the name of the father might be more useful to think about, and for another, the idea of separation from the object. You know, so it's kind of a different ways of thinking that can all be useful clinically.
Mm-hmm.
And to maybe go back to the last part of the book, the idea of the Santon, this late invention of Lacan, a different type of symptoms. One that, that's the what he takes from Joyce, is a type of symptom that could help you avoid the destiny of madness. It's a sort of creative artifice that allows you to live. And so then we can see that at times madness could be a form of invention. And this is what the third section of the book works on. Manya has a beautiful contribution, a chapter on schizophrenic writing, that you could see how, and this is, I think, the originality already in Freud and taken up by Lacan, that in psychosis the delusion could be a spontaneous form of cure, which is a paradox if you approach it from a medical perspective in terms of at times medications are aimed at eliminating the delusion. So in a way, you're medicating the cure. It's interesting to think of the logic also to go back to a point that Manya made, that somebody could be psychotic and not mad all the time. The idea that somebody could be could have a psychotic structure doesn't mean that it's all the time delusional. At times, somebody who is extremely rational, extremely normal, could be very psychotic. And this is something that Darian Leder, who is one of our contributors to the collection, calls quiet psychosis. What I think we see in everyday life, people puzzle, but sudden explosions of psychosis, I think it's important to see that maybe the structure could be there dormant. And one of the contributions we're trying to make with the book is, can we make sense of the structure before it explodes in a parking lot, in a shooting in a movie theater? We only see it perhaps when it's too late, and the idea is that as clinicians perhaps we could see it before.
I have actually, your comments, both of your comments actually stirred up so many questions. Let me see if I can. On the symptom, before we, I've always been confused. Maybe other people out there, maybe this is paradoxical, maybe not, but does the symptom stave off madness, or is it a creative act of madness? So it's a kind of maybe chicken and egg question, or is it a signifier? Like in one of the chapters, I think it was Morel's chapter, there was this case of Ilse, someone she calls Ilse, where there's a being a parent, this phrase or this idea, this notion becomes a symptom. Or is it the act of writing? So in other words, just the very act of doing something that allows one to live, as you put it, Patricia. And I know that, Manya, I remember in your piece on your very talented schizophrenic patient, you, the writer, you said something about delusion being a work of art. So, I mean, how far do we push this idea to, because I could see how it could be controversial, like we're glorifying or somehow, praising or, a state of perhaps distress.
Maybe we need to define the terms. Like when we, I think the notion where we use of art is not art as Beaux-Arts or classical art, but maybe the idea of art, if we go back to the origin of the world, close to techne, know-how. So more than an artist, as an artist we will see in a museum, would be the art of somebody who manages, has a know-how about something, and it would be a know-how with one structure or a know-how with one's unconscious, a way of dealing with, we make do with what one is given one structure. So in that sense, it requires an artistry and also the idea of artifice, that is a creation, and in that sense it's an invention. It's something new, unique for each subject that cannot be industrially produced. And that's the unique thing of the symptom. And we see that in several of the clinical examples in the book, where we can pinpoint that is a solution for that subject in a specific circumstance and given a specific history, structure, situation, conditions, culture, language. Mm-hmm. And maybe Manya wants to add something to that.
Maybe just the idea that it's the idea of the know-how with one structure. So as I said before, just because somebody's schizophrenic doesn't mean they're ill. So that would take away the idea that, oh, we're glorifying somebody's illness. I mean, and think about the millions of artists we know about who are miserable. So I'm not sure that that's like the way to think about it. There's, in fact, the one schizophrenic whose work I talk about in the book, he's incredibly productive and creative, and most spends 99.9% of his life outside of the hospital. You know, so. So that those say suppléances, or what Lacan calls supplements, or like ways of doing something or a know-how, allows them not to be ill.
Right. Okay. That's actually clarifying.
Mm-hmm. And also, I think we hope to convey with the different essays in the book is challenging the idea that times, oh, this is mad, this is nonsense. What we want to reinstate is the fact that there is a logic, there is a method in madness, as the saying goes, but that there is also a logical structure in maybe seemingless, senseless acts, like what's the structure or the logic behind maybe a suicide bomber or somebody who is... in a way, drunk in freedom. I'm mentioning here Nestor Bronstein's piece on the extreme that picks up on Lacan's idea that the mad person is the only truly free person. And what kind of freedom are we talking about? In the same way, what kind of art are we talking about? And I'm trying to understand the logic that these structures follow. Mm-hmm. In order to, and I think this is one of the things I find very nice about all the contributions that are part of this book, is that they offer elements that are helpful, of course, for the clinician, but that will be of interest for academics, graduate students, but also for any lay person who is interested in trying to figure out what madness is about.
Do you think that some of the pieces, some of the chapters, maybe contradict one another a little bit? Because I do feel like there are multiple messages there. Like the Brownstein you mentioned says, I think, that you can't just go crazy. It's the other who chooses. Is this the piece? I think this is the piece where he says that the other chooses for you. It's in fact the choice made by the other rather than the subject. At the same time, there seems to be... something here about, like you said, the radical freedom or unfreedom of the madman. And then I think in your intro, you too say that madness lurks within all speaking beings. And you've said this in the interviews, you know, that there's a kind of, that we all, when we dream, for example, we're all mad perhaps. And so, I mean, I guess it goes back to this. Can anyone just go crazy, or just some of us, or what does it really mean? And do we want to equate going crazy, so, you know, insanity with madness, et cetera? And I do think that there is a vagueness of categories here, maybe a purposeful one. And do you think that the chapters cohere, or do you think that they sometimes speak to one another and say different things? I guess this is...
You know, it was also like, does Lacan's idea always cohere?
No. Of
Lacan's idea of what psychosis is, right? And remember, maybe the idea would be also that, you know, the psychotic is spoken by the other, right? And we can say that language is mad. I mean, language, I mean, we make sense of it because we're neurotic. But if you actually try to think through people's way that they make sense, it's completely mad.
So then the question, if I follow what Manya and Anna elicit, is perhaps what the book will tell the reader is how come we're not all crazy? So what happens that only a few of us may be crazy, not all? But it is a complicated issue, and you raise an important point, because there is this kind of paradox that we make unconscious choices, but they are forced choices. So that when the psychotic person may be, on the one hand, free, and this is conveyed a little by the paradox of the subtitle, madness, yes, you can't. So what kind of choice is when, yes, you can't. So I think this is a little the as Manya was saying, the problem of any speaking being. And some who happen to be neurotic may be more deluded to think that they are awake when they're in fact dreaming, and the mad know they are dreaming while they dream, but then can never wake up. So we enter, I think, I wouldn't say that the different chapters contradict each other, but they offer a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And I would maybe, even for instance, we mentioned Nestor Brunson, he's very aware of the implications of this statement of Lacan, that the only free person is the mad person, and yet it's a very peculiar kind of freedom.
Yeah.
Maybe when you are, yes?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, that when if he's decided, all is decided by the big other, if the other we call language, society. When is not, there is, I think, no case for any human cultural subject when that wouldn't happen. The interesting thing is that some subjects may defend themselves better and other worse, and some may be able to escape a sort of structural destiny of madness, as Manya was saying, the mad element of language that, well, happened that some go crazy and others don't. And we invite the readers to figure out why this happens for some, and what happens when some are mad, and yet, and this is presented in the later notion of Lacan when he proposes a new theory of madness, that some people manage to avoid that destiny. Mm. And they manage to create an invention that could allow them to live with madness without extreme suffering, mm-hmm. which is one of the promises as clinicians ourselves, because both Manya and I practice, is the idea of, well, how could you help somebody suffer less and deal with their structure in a better way, make them mm-hmm. better.
Manya, did you want to add something?
No, I wanted to ask about the idea of freedom, right? So one of the Lacanian ideas is, like, why is the madman free, right? It's because he has what Lacan says the object in his pocket. It's a joke, right? But what he means by that is I mean, and it's funny because I remember working in the hospital and going, what does it mean, like, the object in his pocket, right? Where is it? And it's not so much in his pocket, it's an expression in French, but it's more the idea that there is no separation from the object. So the reason the madman's free is he doesn't lack anything. I mean, we're not free because we lack and we have relations with others and then we have to worry about them and we have the law and all of those things that make us function and not function in the world. But if you don't lack anything, then there's no place to go.
Mm.
Right? There's no place to be. You're not looking for something outside.
But that still seems very, very kind of oppressive freedom, if it is a freedom at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's kind of the idea. Right?
Precisely because it is an oppressive position, what the essays in the book try to show is that in the face of the void, there could be perhaps something one can do to maybe create the space where perhaps some of that void could be breached, that there could be a world when there is a gaping hole.
Uh-huh.
H-O-L-E, as you clarify, because there's too much hole, W-H-O-L-E.
Mm-hmm.
So I think our aim with the collection is to offer the work done by very important thinkers, clinicians, who can offer new strategies to deal with seemingly unapproachable phenomena, because something can be done nevertheless.
Well, you know, Okay. I have two questions. Let me think. Maybe just this first. I remember one of the essays, and maybe it might have been the Yankelevich. I'm not sure, but it was something, there was a statement like that madness is the height of subjectivity or the logical end of subjectivity. And that seemed confusing to me, actually. Do you remember this kind of quote? Am I misquoting?
That doesn't ring a bell.
Okay.
It could go back to the idea.
The utmost point of subjectivity. It was the Van Hula. Sorry, yes.
Okay, yeah. Manya.
because there's no object separated. So what would, like, if we're saying subject is like the symbolic and the real, and there's like no, there's nothing that's fallen out from that encounter, right?
Mm-hmm.
It would make sense. Mm-hmm. You're just like pure. Gerard Pommier says to me, the psychotics he treats are the super subjects.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks.
I think what Van Hule and Fayer's piece talks about is that there is something, because their piece works on how subjectivity is constituted as such, they revisit the idea of the mirror stage, that in a way the inherent fracture that is part of what subjectivity is made out, that we are all speaking beings, we are all divided beings, that type of fracture is more explicit in psychosis, which is something already noted by Freud, that what he observed is working with psychotic patients, is that what would take years and years of explorations and have to be laborly fetched up in neurotics was in psychosis at the surface.
Right.
At the very, accessible to the very eyes. And it's interesting that in if I'm recalling Freud's quote accurately, he talks about visibility. It has to do with the eye, with the gaze, which is precisely what Lacan elaborates when he goes back to the idea, when he invented the idea of the mirror stage as the moment of invention of the ego, when the subject is created as such based on an image, on a reflection, on a mirror, and that has to do with the imaginary, the gaze, and in psychosis we have that at the surface, visible. And it's something that also returns to, and this is very important because it tells us how important, if we want to know about subjectivity, we need to know about psychosis in order to understand all types of structures, all types of subjects, neurotics, psychotics, perverse. Lacan would call the psychotic the martyr of the unconscious, and he's again going back to the etymology of martyr as a witness, is the one who sees what the subject is about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what is clinically very helpful, is that we learn a lot about the subjectivity in general if we learn about psychosis.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's the Alouche piece. He talks about how the structure of transference is always the same, except that the psychotic tries to position himself, or is positioned as the subject supposed to know, as in the analyst spot, is as it were.
But I think even that. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Anna. Not almost that he's trying to position himself. He is.
He is there, so, right? The analyst shouldn't compete with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is there because the other is always making demands and asking questions.
Yeah, they have a direct line to the big other.
Yeah.
They have a lot, because this is one way to say it simply would be that a psychotic person does not have the filter that a neurotic person would have. So they see too much, and they have access to something without the mediation, the repression, the filters that you could find in neurosis. And in that sense, it's a privileged and difficult perspective to have.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you mentioned a little while ago about helping people who are mad, or technique, essentially. And there are a few papers. There are a number of papers actually in the collection about that. And I was thinking about, it seems that there's been a debate, correct me if I'm wrong, among Lacanians about how to view the so-called new symptoms or new madness that Verhaeghe, chapter, I think it's called Today's Madness Does Not Make Sense. And everyone seems to agree or most people seem to agree that there are more and more people are exhibiting these rare psychoses that are actually not so rare. In other words, symptoms that don't resolve with classical treatment and that are rooted in the body, that aren't symbolized, but rather are kind of direct expressions of anxiety. So there's like, they appear psychotic, but they're unaccompanied by hallucinations, paranoia, delusions, and that sort of thing. And so Verhaeghe posits this, solution or a way of dealing with this where he seems to stay within the Freudian and 1950s Lacanian, dichotomy of schizophrenia, paranoia, and adds attachment theory or attachment research to the mix. And he argues that the analyst must enter into a kind of, he might deny that he argues this, but I think he argues for that the analyst must enter into a kind of reparenting transference with the analysand and modulate excess jouissance or control the drives or help the process of creating a delusion to localize or delimit the drives. But there's this other position that Jacques-Alain Miller, it seems, slightly different view. He has a slightly different view, and he describes something he calls ordinary psychosis or untriggered psychosis, where he advocates the formation of a kind of makeshift name of the father or master signifier, which seems closer to the Lacan of the 70s, the Saint-Homme. So he emphasizes the creative act of madness. I seem to think, and please correct me if I've misrepresented the theory at all, but here's my question. I feel like the volume in its overarching message moves from actually a sort of Verhaeghe point of view or the earlier Lacanian position on madness on madness to this later Lacanian position on madness, the one that maybe is deployed more by Miller. Would you agree with this or am I misrepresenting the volume?
Patricia?
Yeah, I was maybe what we try precisely to avoid being pro or against in the volume, because indeed we have many original thinkers and they develop like Paul Verhaeghe is a very original thinker, and he indeed goes back to a very classical notion, that of actual neurosis, that was put forward by Freud and seemingly abandoned, and he finds it very helpful because he has today patients who do not seem to present classical symptoms, and his argument is that they cannot be treated, they cannot be helped if we use a classical orthodox form of treatment. And that's in a way very, very original and also very classical, and we could say that even of Lacan himself. Lacan is such a Freudian, and he's so faithful to Freud that he changed Freud. So I think if our book is so faithful to Lacan that changes, or so faithful to all the contributors that changes what the contributors are saying themselves and makes them enter a conversation, a dialogue, it's well done.
Yeah. It's very dialectical. You're being more Lacan
exactly
than Lacan himself.
That,
yeah.
Exactly, that we are so faithful that we create the dialectic within the text. And, and I'm fascinated listening to you, because one of the things I like of the process of writing is that you think you write a book and then you have a reader and you discover you have written a different book. And that's the wonderful thing of writing, that each reader will rewrite the book. And maybe to perhaps answer to the book you have rewritten with your reading is the idea of the Saint-Homme. I think it's part of Lacan. The idea of the Saint-Homme has to do already with ideas of Freud, as earlier on Emmanuel mentioned. The idea of the delusion as a metaphor is an early Lacanian idea, is already in Freud. And the Saint-Homme, in a way, is not a metaphor, but serves the same function of something that in the 50s Lacan described as the name of the father. The Saint-Homme could replace the name of the father, and what is interesting in the revision, that then the name of the father becomes a symptom. So Lacan is still using the Oedipus complex, but in a way where the Oedipus complex is now Freud's symptom and not anymore something that every person needs to overcome, and then maybe the symptom would be the cure. Because, was, for instance, for Freud, the then, do we ever overcome the Oedipus complexes? That would be the expected evolution of psychic maturity or perhaps even of a psychoanalytic treatment. In terms of our position with psychosis, if you, once you enter each case of psychosis and you have it from the opening case of the book with Rolf Floor's a wonderful case of the baby diaper man, and how we close, if we talk about the arc of the last chapter on schizophrenic writing, you can see that psychosis could be very ordinary and at the same time is extraordinary. In the case of Rolf Floor, he's a homeless man, and in at the end of the book, we have an extremely intelligent and sophisticated person who produces this amazing play with all these layers of complexity. So if you look closely to psychosis, it's hard not to think that each case of psychosis is extraordinary. And I think what is perhaps important to rescue in Miller's position would be the idea that at times psychosis, and is what the Darian Leader calls quiet psychosis, could look very ordinary and still be a very complex structure that is not within the order one would expect if we play with the idea of order and ordinary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's important maybe to be aware, again, what we said before, that psychosis is not necessarily nonsensical, is not necessarily mad. Psychosis could be extreme intelligence, extreme rationality, and extreme adaptation, extreme normalcy, that the most normal person could be the most psychotic.
Or ordinary. Well,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
The commonplace.
In the beginning, to mention that, you know, much madness is divinest sense, and sense is darkest madness.
Mm. Right. Actually, okay. I would like to just move. We don't have a ton of time left, so I just wanted to ask a question about the body before we start to wrap up, because there is that one article about Merleau-Ponty's phenomenology, and I was and comparing to the Lacanian position on the body. And as I was reading it, I really enjoyed that chapter, because in part because I find that I have a lot of I often hear from friends who are into phenomenology that Lacanians deny the body, and they ask me this, like, you know, defend this, you know, Lacanians don't care about the body. I read Bruce Fink, and he tells me no, and the body doesn't matter, the gestures don't matter, etc. And there's this wonderful footnote, actually, in the Ferrets and Van Hula, where they compare the Merleau-Ponty and Lacan, and they say so Merleau-Ponty believes, he talks about the so-called live body, the pre-objectified body before the mirror. So we normally repress this body because we think of our body as something, as an object, like in a world of other pre-made or already made objects. Anyway, so he's this footnote. Maybe I can read the footnote, and you guys can comment on it or tell me anything about you feel about the piece or the body and Lacan. But to the extent that Merleau-Ponty's recourse to the body results in an unproblematic embodied subjectivity, it also represents the unthought remainder that threatens to haunt the temporal logic of natural repression and concomitantly proves to be a serious drawback to his phenomenology. It is precisely at this point that Lacan's Cartesian subjectivity and the real of the body can provide a welcome alternative.
Maybe this comment, and I imagine Manya will have a lot to add, to bring into consideration that there is something, a lot to learn about the body precisely through madness. Lacan, for instance, discovers through his reading of Joyce, there is a slight moment of madness, we may call, in Lacan himself, because he confused Joyce, the author, with the character Stephen in Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man. Mm-hmm. But it is a very peculiar kind of body that is often a body encountered in psychosis. Is a body that can fall, can slip away like an envelope devoid of its contents. So there is something very prevalent of the experience of the body in the experience of psychosis. And I think Lacan is very attentive to that. But the body is already preoccupation for Lacan in the 30s with the creation of the mirror stage, because it is, we think we have a body, and I think language betrays the strange relationship we have with the body. We are not bodies, we have bodies, so we have right. to assume a body that is through the mirror stage, through the babies looking at the reflection in the mirror and encountering this reflection of a baby held by probably the mother or the main caretaker, that will give an illusion of a self before such a thing exists, the illusion of an ego before there is an ego. And that's how an ego is created, as one acquires an ego. And this is something that Lacan returns to when he's working with Joyce, because he will describe Joyce as somebody without an ego. And it's something that Joyce was already speculating in his notes, that he was imagining Stephen as a character without an ego. And it's something we see a lot. The body, as an image of the body, is not fully achieving psychosis. It's more the real of the body. We see that really in Schreber, a body that is in a state of putrefaction, where the organs acquire a very peculiar activity and a body that can transform. In the case of Schreber, from being a male body, it becomes a female body, and miracles and horrors can take place in that body. And I imagine Manya may have.
Mm-hmm. Yes? Would you say it's not an integrated body? It's not like it's
an
a fragmented
body. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. An integrated body is also a canceled body by language. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Your idea, even the idea of integration, it has to do with a kind of annulling that language functions in neurosis, right?
Right.
I mean, I think Patricia is right. When the body is real, I'm thinking of the patient that I wrote about. He once said that my body is my soul.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when we think of the soul, we think of some kind of metaphoric thing, right? But
uh-huh.
I mean, here it brings up the question of the other of language, but also the fact that the body is real in psychosis. And it goes back to something earlier, Anna, when you mentioned like schizophrenia paranoia. I mean, in paranoia, the mirror stage is made in some way, at least attempted, right? In schizophrenia,
right.
it's not so developed. I mean, the mirror stage. So, and in the case of the patient where his body is his soul, we can say it's definitely more on the schizophrenic side.
Mm. I'm surprised by this idea of the absence of the body, because I'm thinking of the essays in the collection. The body, I think I could see examples of the body in so many of the contributions to the collection. I think in most cases where there is a clinical example, something of the body is touched, because as Manya was saying, is in fact the body is there in its crude reality as flesh more than as an imaginary body or a symbolic body. So
I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding where people, because what's lacking in Lacan is this kind of, you know, faith in the body as the locus of truth, as something that speaks
exactly
truth.
Mm-hmm. That the body, that because it's not so much the body seen by the analyst as the body as expressed by the analyst. So, and the only way, but this is true of every, so when one goes to the doctor, who supposedly would deal with the real of the body, we need to fill out a form, and the doctor may ask, why are you here today? And one starts speaking and describing symptoms. It's always, we cannot avoid the traps of language, the madness of language, as we were saying earlier on. So it is always within language. And I think this is what is great for us, analysts, because we have equivocation as our weapon. And since it's a talk therapy, psychoanalysis will exploit all the equivocal potential of language to the benefit of the treatment. It is interesting to know that when someone is psychotic, their relation to language will be a very special one, and that equivocal nature of language will be addressed differently. and we produce different symptoms, and as a result, we produce a different type of body.
Maybe it also reminds me of our essays in here. We didn't like the ones on melancholia, right?
Yes.
Because the like in I think Russell Griggs,
yeah,
mm-hmm. right on the like proximity or the non-abandoned objects, right? So those are also ways of addressing the body in the melancholia essays, and also in Claude Noel's essay about femininity, the body's very much addressed.
Claude Noel, Pickman, yes, absolutely,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or even in Richard Boothby.
Yeah,
I was thinking
suicide bomber essay, right?
Yeah, exactly. The body explodes in the case of a suicide bomber. So, it's interesting to know that. I think there is something very. It's in the front stage, I would say, the body in an experience of a psychosis, and I think in general in psychoanalysis, the question is that we will not stop. In what the analyst may see or may not see about the body.
Yeah, I think what maybe some people again are looking for is this sort of Merleau-Ponty position of the body as constitutive of perception and subjectivity. The body is somehow pre-mirror, and that there one can access that, you know, that there's actually that's even possible.
What is the truth? The truth.
That one can. Well, I should say that. I mean, one could argue in psychosis you do access that, or that's the only thing you have. So, anyway, we should probably wrap up, unfortunately. But I wanted to ask you about what you're working on now, because I know you two have another volume in the works, right? Together.
Yes. We had a wonderful experience in. Working together on this collection, we discover, at least I will talk for myself, I discover how much fun it is to write with someone else. That it was really a very different experience, that the painful aspect of writing disappeared, was just the challenge and the difficulties of the task at hand, but that the overall the process was fun, and there was something that was new to discover painless writing. I don't know what Maya may ask.
Amazing. I have to talk to you more about this after the interview. Yeah. Anya, is this true
maybe
for you too?
I would say that the yes you can. I mean, writing, I think writing is a yes you can't, right? I mean, all the time. And maybe the writing together made the yes part larger than the you can't part, right?
Yeah, was the power of yes more than the power of can't. Yeah.
Right, we're working on a book on that we already have in manuscript form on laughter, and we're very excited about it. On psychoanalysis and laughter, and psychoanalysis and comedy, right? And with reference to laughter, humor, all those parts that we found that there's very little literature on this. I mean, there's some, but very, very little. And, I mean, of course, the classic Freud text on jokes and humor, but just about clinical practice, about comedy in general, and also we're trying to think about a new paradigm in our book for psychoanalysis. Comedy is a new paradigm for psychoanalysis as opposed to tragedy, as opposed to Oedipus, Hamlet, and Antigone, you know, Lubitsch and Billy Wilder.
You're right, though. There isn't a ton on laughter and psychoanalysis. It's true. Terrific. What about, I know that, is anybody working on also other individual, are you writing stuff on your own, too?
Yes, and I am. That one is, the pain is there on that one, because I'm working, I'm completing a manuscript called Psychoanalysis Needs a Sex Change, his Lacanian Approaches to Social and Sexual Difference. That's almost done, so the pain will be over soon, and we finish already the manuscript on psychoanalysis, Lacan psychoanalysis and comedy, that we were saying with Manya, we propose a paradigm shift that is a Freudian sleep on a banana peel. So we want to, we find more helpful as a clinical strategy, using that of comedy, also in terms of a scholar approach to, I think psychoanalysis has a lot to say about comedy. It's very interesting that in tragedy the hero dies, in comedy the hero falls in the soup and survives. So maybe with that idea that we can write and survive, we will continue with that project.
This gives me hope.
Exactly. One can fall into the soup, but perhaps using more the model of comedy than that of tragedy. Mm-hmm. That might be more helpful.
I really can't wait for this. Thank you both so much. It was really fun, and and just to remind everybody, I've been speaking with Patricia Garavici and Manya Steinkohler about Lacan on madness. Madness, yes, you can't. So thanks to you, and thanks to our audience for listening. Until next time, so long. Mm-hmm.